Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Sam in the Morning with Jen, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to the show. Today is Thursday, April 9th, and we're here with you. No need to worry. We're here every morning.
Yes, we are.
To entertain, help you wake up. We're your caffeine shot in the morning.
Yes.
You definitely can't say that we're boring.
No,
if I do say so myself.
Right.
Right? Somebody's going to give us compliments, I guess.
That's true.
Yeah.
Is there a way for listeners to write to us somewhere?
Not really. I mean, sometimes I get emails on my email, and you have your email on the website too, right? We put it on your page?
No, my website's there. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, but sometimes on Facebook too, but not that many. I don't know. People are not that involved. They just listen and they move on.
Got it.
But, you know, I mean, you know, people expect internet radio to be different from the same as traditional radio, but it's different. I mean, these times are different, you know.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was just curious because, After Buzz, for instance, the other show that I do, under all of, our YouTube uploads and on our iTunes, we, encourage people to write to us.
I see. Okay.
So they, rate us, review us, they give us feedback, they ask us questions. So it's a big – the engagement is a big part of it, but it's
That's
different.
True because I think also because you guys deal with shows that people like, you know, they sort of connect to the shows.
Yeah.
So you're creating sort of a community or something of people.
Yeah, there's a lot of engagement.
Right. That's pretty cool, actually.
Yeah.
So what shows are you covering now? I mean, are you covering anything?
About to start a couple. I think one of them is called Grace and Frankie. It's a Netflix show.
Okay.
So we're going to do that one, I believe. And then also maybe The Real Housewives of New York.
Hmm. Interesting.
That's just for spring.
And but then, you don't like those reality shows, do you?
Yeah.
Oh, you do like them? Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, I mean, they're like a train wreck, right?
Yeah, I mean some of them are a little bit too negative for me, and then there are some that are very entertaining.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Which one do you like best? I mean, have you watched a few of them, different cities?
Yeah.
And which one do you like
best? I watch Real Housewives of New York and Beverly Hills.
Beverly Hills, yeah. I guess those would be interesting, right?
Yeah, I mean, I like the cast of each of those shows, and then also... they're both more relevant to me than Atlanta because I don't go to Atlanta.
Right, that's true.
So I don't really know that area, you know. So New York and Beverly Hills to me are way more interesting.
Yeah, you can relate to them more.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know. Plus you think people from New York or LA are a little crazy, you know. I mean,
there's crazy people everywhere.
I guess in Atlanta, don't they have that woman that's became a star out of it or something? I don't know what her name is.
People from all of the shows became very
stars,
big celebrities,
really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Interesting. You know, we talk about that. I wanted to bring up they're talking about how Dancing with the Stars people hook up and stuff, you know. And my reaction is, duh, you know. I mean, you spend days together.
Right.
You know, and it's the same thing with making a movie, you know. That's why you see so many romances come out of it.
Right.
You're not going to have a man and a woman working that intimately and not connect somehow.
Right.
You know, I mean, I'm sure they also had to give their okay to their dancing partner, too. I mean, they're just, I don't think they would just connect them with anyone, you know. I mean, I'm sure they're asking, well, do you want to be with that one, with that one?
I don't think that is how it works.
No?
No,
so
I've heard interviews about...
Pair them up?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know the process for which they do it, but I've heard dancers with their partners on morning shows talk about how they were paired with their person.
I see. Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, actually, that's more interesting because then you don't know how they're going to react and everything.
Right. You're more thrown into it.
Right.
And then there's also that dynamic of will they get along? Won't they get along?
Right.
Does the person take instruction well? Are they unteachable? You know?
Yeah.
So I think it adds to that layer of drama.
Right. Yeah. But I think there's a reason for like a reason to worry for spouses or significant others of people in entertainment. People
totally.
That do that, you know, because it's hard to deal with this.
You did
know?
They say who hooked up recently or?
Yeah, I mean, they're saying, yeah, they have like about nine cases. Maxim Chemerovsky and Karina Smirnoff or something. Then there's, I mean, I don't really know these people, but I guess they're like, okay, Mario Lopez and Karina Smirnoff. So that happened in 2006. Wow, that's a long time ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's see if there's anything more recent. I guess the show's run for a long time.
Yeah.
For many years. That's why.
Who is the most recent?
I don't know. They're not going by recency. Okay, November 2014. Val Chemerovsky again.
They're brothers.
Chmerkovsky. Oh, really? It's two different guys?
Yeah.
Okay, and Janelle Parrish. Yeah, I don't know.
Okay.
So, yeah, let's see who else. Yeah, I should definitely start watching more TV.
The recent Bachelor is on there currently, Chris Soules.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. So, yeah, you see, some people have all the luck, you know. He gets on The Bachelor, then he does on Dancing with
well,
the
I think
Stars.
It's a contract.
Oh, it is?
Yeah.
To do like multiple shows?
Well, it's ABC, so if
right.
you... are The Bachelor, you're probably committed after to do Dancing with the Stars.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
It just keeps it going.
Yeah.
It's a machine.
Yeah.
Smart.
Yeah.
Very smart.
Do you watch Dancing with the Stars?
No, I don't.
Yeah.
It always conflicted, I think, with The Voice or other shows I watch, so I never got into it.
Right.
And I do love dancing. I mean, I just don't watch that show.
Yeah. I know. Sometimes I catch it, but it's, yeah. I don't know. I've yet to find a show that would capture my imagination, although I admittedly I haven't tried many, so I don't know. But, yeah, what can you do? You know, television's not everything. In a few minutes, we're going to have an author calling in from Israel. He was going to call in on Monday, but that was, I think, my mistake because we never really finalized a day. So... he's going to call today. It's evening there right now. It's about 8 o'clock there in the evening. So it's a cool thing he's going to be calling. I'm glad it's not in the middle of the night. You know, when you interview people in Australia or something,
yeah.
it's the middle of the night,
yeah.
you know.
Speaking of Israel, how are your parents doing with moving here?
It's all on hold because my young brother... They're waiting for him to come and visit with his baby from China.
Ah.
So after that happens, we're going to bring him here. The biggest problem is it's hard to find houses here. There's like no houses for sale. I mean, nobody's selling.
Weren't you thinking of renting to just get them here?
Yeah, we may have to do that until we find something.
Right.
Yeah, because I don't want to waste any more time. I mean, every day is precious that it's being wasted.
Plus, then you don't have to rush to like pick a house. You can rent a house and then... take your time to find the perfect house.
Yeah, absolutely. But it does cost money, you know, to rent.
Yes.
So when you buy, you just buy it.
Right.
You know. So it's hard. But here comes the call from 972. That's the code for Israel. So let's go ahead and answer this. Good morning. You're on the air. Is this our guest from Israel?
Hi. Yes, this is Nir Zamir.
Yes, Nir, how you doing? Thank you for calling in.
Sure, thank you for having me.
Of course. So I was telling everybody it's nighttime where you are, but it's not too late. So it worked out great for you to call in at this time.
Absolutely, thank you.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about your book. We sort of met on Facebook. You posted something on our page, and it grabbed me right away because, as you can imagine, being an Israeli and stuff, seeing an Israeli author writing about espionage and terrorists and a lot of action, I'm there.
Right.
You know, it doesn't doesn't require a lot because I love to read. So, Nir, so your book is The Killing Rituals, and when was it published? Did it just come out?
It was published a few months ago.
Uh-huh.
And then in the last several weeks, it really reached very good places, ratings on Amazon.
Wow, very cool.
Got to be number one bestseller in the espionage and political thriller sections,
and several other
Amazon categories. So it's very exciting.
Very cool. And you know, now I mean, with today, when you have stores like Amazon and stuff, the entire world can read your books. You know, it's not just a local thing, and then you have to break into a new market and so forth, right?
Correct. Yeah, it's very encouraging. I'm seeing through Amazon, it's very easy to see where your book is being responded to and purchased. And so far, it's been picked up in, you know, certainly throughout the United States, the UK, Australia, and also other non-English speaking countries as well. So it's quite encouraging.
Yeah, definitely. Now, did you write this book originally in Hebrew or in English? What language did you write it in?
No, I wrote it in English. I have dual citizenship.
Okay.
I lived for 10 years in New York, so I write and read mostly in English.
Right. Awesome. Awesome. Well, the writing is great. I already downloaded the Kindle edition, and I started reading this, and it's a fascinating story, like right from the headlines, you know? So how did you get the idea for the book?
Well, I've been a soldier in one governmental organization or other for the most part of my adult life. I served in the Israeli Army Special Forces and then served in the Secret Service for many years. And so I was really part of this, of the world that I'm describing in the book, the world of anti-terrorism. And I've had the passion to write about it for quite some time. And I think that as time goes by, unfortunately, international terrorism has become a really present component of almost everybody's life.
Right.
And so that was something that was burning in me for quite some time. So I sat down and wrote it.
Wow, very cool. Had you written anything before this one?
Well, I published a short story a while back when I was still living in New York. In the North American Review. It was a nonfiction story about the war in Lebanon, in fact.
Wow, very interesting. So you've got quite a bit of background. When did you serve in the Israeli military?
Starting in back in the mid-70s.
Oh, okay.
And then, as you know, in Israel... Yeah. In Israel, you serve for at least three years, and then you keep serving until, in my case, in your 50s,
right.
In the reserve unit. So quite a long time. And
yeah.
In the middle, I served in the Secret Service, as I said, for about 10 years.
Wow, 10 years. That must have been like a life. But is that everything that we see in the movies, or I would imagine it's not as glamorous, right?
No, it's not as glamorous, but oftentimes it surpasses the imagination and the stories that we see in movies. To be honest,
right? Now let me ask you this: What drives a person to get into, like, let's call it espionage, secret service? How does somebody get into something like this, and why? I mean, what were your reasons? Because I mean, obviously, you're risking your life.
Yeah, but when you grow up in a community that kind of educates you and drives you to be patriotic on the one hand, and instills values like, you know, giving to the community and protecting others the way, you know, those who came before you protected you, it's quite a natural step. I think it's very, at least for most people in Israeli society, it's a very natural step as you reach that age.
I see. After you're in the military and you realize what's going on, Yeah. Now, for those of you who don't know, in Israel, military is mandatory. You have to go when you're 18 till you're 21. Now, women, I know things have changed quite a bit, but do women have to go as well?
Yes.
They
yes,
do have to go.
Women still have to serve. They have to serve 2 years.
Uh-huh.
As opposed to 3 years, as you mentioned, by men.
Right.
But they do have to serve, that's correct.
I see, okay. So not much has changed. It used to be like that for many years. So we grew up at about the same time. You know, I was a teenager in the 70s as well, and we probably have similar backgrounds and stuff. So this is cool for me, Jen. You know, I'm like, I can totally relate to this.
Right.
But my path was so different, you know, because I was sent here at 16 to the United States, and I never got to experience the military. And then when I finally decided, you know what, I really want to maybe experience this and see what it's all about, I was too old to do anything meaningful there, you know.
But you know,
and you're sent here as a kid, you start a life, and you don't think about it. But I'm very connected to Israel, and I know that people, although it's mandatory, many people feel privileged to serve there. And like you said, to protect your country, because it's so small, it's threatened all the time, under threat continuously.
Right.
So you do whatever it takes, and you know, I admire this, because I think it took, you went outside of yourself and you decided, you know what, I'm going to follow what other people have done before me and protect my people.
Correct.
Yeah.
That's the notion most people share. I agree.
Yeah. Now, we're talking to Nir Zamir. He's an author of the book, The Killing Rituals. Tell us briefly what the book is dealing with.
Well, the main story is really a time-sensitive chase between a binational organization, an agency set up by the U.S. and Israel to combat international terrorism, and a Palestinian terrorist cell that is generating terrorist campaign, a terrorist campaign throughout Europe, and is about to launch a catastrophic attack at a very certain time. And the two protagonists, really, the story is driven by two agents, one from the Israeli side, from the Mossad, which is the equivalent of the CIA, and one agent, an African-American lady, on the CIA side.
I see.
These two characters are driving the story, but in fact, throughout the story, you get to meet a lot of other characters, and of course, also on the Palestinian side. And I hope, this is what I try to do at least, I hope that the story really presents both sides of the issue in a balanced form.
Right. And I think that's a responsibility as an author, especially for fiction. You know, you don't want to, I know some people inject their own views and their opinions on in their books, but I think in a fiction book, it's not so much about expressing your own views as about, you know, telling it the way it is, you know. And I can see the, you know, obviously there is the other side of these things. And I think it helps when you understand them, you know. And I would imagine in your work and stuff, you were involved with things similar to this as well, right?
That's correct. Yes,
yeah.
Indeed.
Wow. So now, the book, does it take place in the present now, or is it in the past?
No, it's set in the 80s.
In the 80s, okay.
During the 80s, the middle of the 80s, really. If you look at history, international terrorism really took a giant step forward. I think today there's probably no one who is not aware of what's going on in that respect in the world, with ISIS, high-profile activities, and other terrorists and atrocities around the world. But back in the 80s, terrorism was just starting to raise its head, so
right,
to speak.
Right.
And most of it, a lot of it, was generated from the Israeli-Palestinian or Israeli-Arab conflict, unfortunately.
Yeah.
So the book starts from there.
Yeah. Wow. So, now, in your adventures in, well, I'm calling it adventures, but to you it was a career. Did you ever feel your life was threatened?
Yes, of course. There's no way to avoid being in situations like that, of course.
Yeah. Now, I wanted to ask...
in the army and in...
Go on.
I mean, both in the army and the Secret Service, of course.
Right, right. Now, I wanted to ask you about the situation with ISIS and stuff. You know, so far, the fighting has been, let's say, confined to Syria and Iraq, and obviously, you know, things all over the world that they do. But so far, they, I know they've threatened Israel, but it's not like at the top of their list. That's kind of unusual,
right,
wouldn't you say?
Well, I think ISIS is a unique phenomenon, but it's certainly a natural evolution of what we've had before. It's just the technology and social networks and media enable it to generate, to resonate much stronger in more people's awareness and lives. And you're right, it's, ISIS is not currently threatening Israel per se, but it probably will.
Right.
And it probably will not, this phenomenon will not remain contained only in the Middle East, in the countries that it's present now. That's for sure, I'm afraid.
Right. And that's the thing, you know, I mean, Israel keeps having like new threats and new enemies. And, you know, obviously this is not a new enemy, but in its current form, you know, it's got some different objectives. You know, I mean, obviously they want to create a caliphate there, and they want the entire Middle East and then the world to become Islamic. So obviously Israel is going to be,
right,
yeah, it's going to come up soon. You know, as soon as they make their advances. Now, Jen and I sometimes talk about it because she feels people are, you know, that the countries are, some of the countries, the allies are doing something about it. I mean, do you feel that the world, the West, is really addressing the problem the way it should be addressed, or are we still underestimating what they can do?
I think we are grossly underestimating this threat,
right,
unfortunately. And I think that, as for what you said earlier, I think not just, of course, Israel is in a very unique position in terms of being exposed to terrorist threats and other types of military threats with Iran and everything. But I think it really is the whole Western world and the Western way of life that is consistently being threatened. And the war is waged not just at Israel when it comes to terrorism.
Right.
And the new thing with ISIS is that it's no more a hidden agenda. I mean, this organization plainly, openly,
right,
says that it's going to hurt as many Western values and assets as it can. So I think it's clearly before us, and I agree with you that Western governments have not yet picked up on this issue and are not responding forcefully enough, I believe.
Right. You're right. You're right. You know, and it really concerns me because I'm like really involved in this because I see this as a big threat to our lifestyle. And the thing is that, yeah, no, nobody's off limits for them. You know, I mean, they kill other Muslims.
Absolutely.
As well.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's not just
and
Christians.
9/11 was a big manifestation of that, a very clear signal.
Right, exactly. And people don't understand this, you know. I mean, they don't, you know, many people don't understand where ISIS came from, and that's actually from Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And, you know, and people don't understand that it is Al-Qaeda, it is the same enemy, and we have to do something.
Correct.
And for some reason, our government is not taking it seriously. You know, and that really concerns me because once we wake up, I think it might be a little late.
I agree with you. I share the same concerns.
Wow. Wow, very cool. Now, finally, well, we're talking to Nir Zamir. The book is The Killing Rituals. And Nir has been in the Israeli Special Forces and the Secret Service and so forth. So he's definitely well qualified to write a novel about anti-terrorism. And Jen, any questions that we haven't asked yet?
Not from me.
Yeah, Jen would rather stay away from this stuff, right?
I mean, I find it interesting. I just don't have any, you know, substantial things to offer to it because I'm not educated in it. So.
Well, it's fine. Some people have no idea what they're talking about, and they do. But
I prefer not to.
Yeah, well. Yeah. Well, dear, thank you so much. People can find the book, obviously, on Amazon. The book is The Killing Rituals. Have you put up a website or anything that people can go to, or can they find you on social networks?
Yeah, they can find me and the book on Facebook. There's a book page by that name, The Killing Rituals.
Okay.
Not yet a website, but I should probably create one. You're right.
Yeah, probably. And, yeah, everybody has a website today, you know, even grandmothers do. but your battlefield is in the bookstore and, you know, being on Amazon and everything, that's cool. And I congratulate you for the book. I mean, it must feel pretty good.
Thank you so much.
Sure. How long did it take you to write it, Nir?
Ooh, years.
Really? Wow. Yeah.
Years, yeah.
So it just states there, and then it's like a little baby coming out, right? When it finally
it's
comes out.
Yeah, it's that experience. But I had to juggle between my other career in high-tech marketing, so it took a lot of time, but it was a great experience.
Oh, I see. Okay. So you're in high-tech marketing. That's pretty cool. A lot of high-tech happening in Israel. Can you discuss briefly what it is that you do, or is it...
Sure. Nowadays, I'm the marketing manager for Dell, the U.S.
computer company. Right.
So I'm the marketing manager in Israel.
Oh, wow.
And before that, I served several other international technology companies that came out of Israel, but ended up being quite large global corporations in the telecom area. And the oil and gas area and communications.
I see. Interesting. And you lived in the States for 6 years, you said, in New York?
For 10 years, yes.
Oh, 10 years. Okay,
I
wow.
Worked, yeah. I was on Madison Avenue most of the time there. My training was in marketing communications, so I was an art director and creative director for Young Rubicam and Gray Advertising.
Wow, very cool, man, very cool. So what made you decide to move back to Israel? Did you miss it? Did you miss home? Did you come here originally for a limited time?
No, you're right. I did miss home, and especially when I had two daughters. My two elder daughters were born in New York, and when it came time for them to enter the education system, it kind of was a... decision and a natural step to enroll them in Israeli school, and that's why we came back.
Right. Very cool. Very cool. Nir, definitely an interesting story of your life, and the book is great. Like I said, I started reading this, and I can't stop. You know, I mean, this is definitely my kind of thriller.
Thank you.
Of course. So, and by a fellow Israeli, too, from the same generation, how can I say no, you know? So everybody go out and get the book, The Killing Rituals, on Amazon. Nir Zamir, thank you so much for joining us. And
Thank you both very much.
Sure, and much success in everything that you do.
Thanks a lot. Have a great day.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Ciao.
So, yeah. Well, as you can imagine, I'm close to this topic, so
yes,
that's where you are. But but for people that like this kind of stuff, go ahead and get the book. I highly recommend it. And these books are pretty popular, you know. I mean, there's like there's a lot of espionage stuff going on. And the funny thing is, you know, the enemy used to be Russia.
Right.
You know, and or the Soviet Union at the time. So, you know, during the Cold War, almost every espionage book was about Russia and the fight, you know, and the nuclear race and so forth. And now the enemy is different. Now the enemy is a lot harder to fight because it's not really a country, you know, and there's no, like, conventional rules of war, you know. And, I mean, there are, like, laws, international laws of how you can fight war, you know, like you can't torture soldiers, you know, you can't do this with civilians, blah, blah, blah. There's a lot of things. And ISIS is breaking every possible rule there is, mm-hmm. you know. So it's like obviously crimes against humanity, war crimes and everything. But, you know, like I said, you know, not a lot's been done about it. Just like with the Nazis, man. It took a long time for the world to wake up.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's talk about some more about happier things. Although the shooting in South Carolina is not that happy a thing, but is at the top of the news.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing is, I guess the cop shot Walter Scott eight times. And there's a video that shows that. Yeah. I mean, those shots come one after another. And they were analyzing the video on CNN, and they showed, so they had to do real close-ups and stuff, and obviously it's pretty blurry. So they're trying to figure out what it is that the cop dropped and then was trying to pick up, you know. And they're saying it's probably a taser gun. Now, his contention was that, I guess, the Walter Scott, that's his name, was trying to go for his taser gun. So that's why he shot him. But, you know, people are saying he was getting away from the taser, and that's why he was running away.
Yeah, I don't think that you can shoot somebody that's running away. They're not causing a threat to you if they're running away.
Right, and no weapon, and with their back to you.
Right.
I think this is definitely something a cop should know.
Well, that's why he's arrested for murder.
Right.
So.
And they're saying he could get the death penalty, too. I mean, can you imagine? But, you know what? I think he deserves this, because especially during these sensitive times now, you can't like reinforce this feeling that the police are bad, you know, and they're after us and after black males. It's not what we need to see.
No, and I think that's why, you know, President Obama wants to instill cameras on cops, and I think that it should happen.
Right.
I think that particular state or something was trying to implement that as well, and so now it's a good time to do it.
Yeah. Before things get out of control. I mean, obviously, people have had problems with police for a long time. I still prefer to think that for the most part, there are good cops who are there to help us and risk their lives for us.
The thing is when people are involved in any aspect, there's error.
Right.
Because we are not imperfect people. So, of course, there's going to be bad cops. There's going to be bad everything.
Right.
But hopefully there's a lot of good cops. Just like doctors. I mean, there's doctors that do malpractice. There's right. doctors that, like, give out prescriptions like it's nobody's business. There's doctors that are alcoholics. Like, right. you can't expect everybody to be perfect just because that's what their career is. That's their career. That's not who they are as a person.
Right. I know. But to put a gun in the hands of someone like that. But then again, you can't know in advance.
Of course.
You never know. And this is a split-second decision, and he's going to have to live with it.
Right.
You know.
And also, I mean, the same thing goes for, like, airline pilots. Are you a good person just because you're an airline pilot, or are you right. a good airline pilot because you're a good person?
Right.
It doesn't – you don't know. And then somebody could drive a plane into a mountain.
Yeah. That's true. That's very true. But it's happening too much.
Or maybe we're just finding out about it more.
Yeah.
Because there's so many avenues for, you know, giving the news.
Yeah.
And everybody's a journalist now, so.
Yeah, I know. And there's media everywhere, you know, and videos everywhere.
Which, you know, we could equate it to Big Brother, but they just knew that technology would take over. And I don't think that it's a bad thing.
Yeah. No, not necessarily, you know.
I mean, don't think surveillance, when it's there to protect or identify or give as evidence, is a bad thing.
Right. I know, but sometimes maybe we're too naive, you know. They just released a report that the government has been following phone calls, monitoring phone calls for decades.
And truthfully, who cares? Because if you're not doing anything wrong, who cares? That's I mean, I don't care. Do they want to hear my conversation with my mom about how she gets her hair done every Friday? I don't think they care.
Yeah, but that's you. You know, I mean, there's people that, you know, maybe someone you know has something confidential that they shouldn't be monitored, you know, and whether it's business or anything related, you know. I mean, you don't
but
know.
But how confidential could it be? And, like, if it gets out, or, like, if the government, who's supposed to protect us, finds out about it, like, what's right. the trouble with that?
Right. Well, you know, again, because I think it's abuse of government power, and they could start doing other things as well, you know.
I agree. I just think we can't have it both ways. I don't think we can have them protect us and then also be mad at them for trying to protect us or trying to know things and get ahead of whatever the curve is so that they then can protect us.
Right.
Or people that are doing things that are illegal can't say, well, that was an invasion of privacy. Well, you also shouldn't be doing something illegal.
No, that's true. That's true. But that's what I'm saying. We're talking about people that would like to have their privacy and don't want anybody into their business, you know.
Right.
But, yeah, I don't know. There's nothing I guess we can do now. But, yeah. I don't know. I mean, it's a mixed bag, you know. It's hard to say because also, you know, when they do the searches in the airport and stuff, you know, and they stop with, they even search old ladies in wheelchairs and stuff. Yeah, you know, they're trying to protect us. I don't have a problem with that.
I don't either.
Right. But because that's you. I mean, when you fly, you decide and you're acknowledging that, yeah, I'm going to submit myself to a body search if so happens.
Right. And I'm okay with it because then I know other people are getting the same search and that will keep the bad guys off my plane.
Right. Exactly. You know, but when you
I giggle as I go through that. I always giggle. I'm like, hee hee, go find the bad guys. Like, it's clearly not me. I'm like, you know, a little like innocent baby. But I get excited knowing other people around me are getting searched. And right. I like, okay, first of all, I think Israel has it right that they do like profiling,
right.
And I remember going to Israel and I was in JFK because I had to fly out of New York, and they were asking me the questions, and I was like fascinated by what they were asking me, and I was like, what does that tell you? Like, what are you gathering from this information? I clearly know I didn't do anything and I packed my own bag, but like, it just fascinates me that they can profile somebody and by their reactions to certain questions, like,
they can tell.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, and by the way they look, by the way they talk, everything is game, you know, because you're talking about saving people's lives, you know, and you do whatever it is, you don't start thinking politically correct. And right. that's in a way what you're saying about the phone calls that are being monitored. You know, if they think it helps national security, then they do it.
Right.
You know, but then again, I mean, the reason it's a controversy and a big deal is because you know, it still has to do with privacy, and people have to. It's not so much about being politically correct, but about what the government should be allowed to do and how much power should it have
right.
over its people.
I just think that, like, because we are people, and we are the people deciding what happens in government, and we are the people that control government, and we make all these decisions as human beings, it's never going to be perfect because we are the flaw in the system.
Yeah.
People and their ideas and their emotions and what they think is right or wrong.
Right.
Who said that you know what's right or wrong?
Right. Well, that's a pretty cynical view, but
no, I don't think I think it's actually more existential because, like, we're the ones governing ourselves and making these decisions and then saving ourselves from each other.
Yeah.
It's all people.
Right.
So it's never going to be, like, that's why, like, there's not a uniform system.
Right.
There's not a uniform system of beliefs, even in terms of, like, ISIS. And there's so many groups. One group is not the same as the other group. They all have a little bit different of a belief system.
Right.
So who's right out of all the terrorist groups?
Right.
I just think that when it's always going to involve people, there's never going to be an answer.
Right. And that's why, you know, I mean, that's philosophically, that's why I think the universe was created for people to go through all these things and figure out, you know, right. what's going on and stuff.
I mean, don't get me wrong. I don't think that it's bad that it's run by people. That's not right. my take on it. I'm just saying right. that, like, when people are hoping for this, like, brilliant answer, well, you're dealing with humans.
No, that's true. But sometimes you expect more from certain people that are more trained, you know, more talented, more gifted in some ways to behave in a certain way. You know, and I think, like with our cops, for example, you expect them not to shoot people unless these people are like very dangerous.
But you're also relying on their training.
Right.
You're, like, okay, what about these military soldiers that go rogue?
Right.
Or then, you know, decide that they like have Stockholm syndrome and they become like their captors.
Right.
And it, like, what's that, Bergdahl, who came back and they expected him to be like a good soldier, but like, right, they also thought maybe he was turned.
Right.
He's a human.
Yeah.
So he was trained as like our soldier, but then he was also turned or could have been turned. Like,
right,
that's because he's a human.
Right.
He didn't say one day, he wasn't born as a soldier.
Yeah.
That isn't his genetic makeup.
Right.
He was trained. And with any training, you can be untrained.
Yeah. That's true. Yeah.
Doesn't also make you, like, you're a cop. Okay, great. So you trained to be a cop.
Right.
But you weren't born a good person or a bad person. So, like, who knows what's going to happen in your life.
Right. No, that, I mean, that's true, you know. But you would expect that we could feel safe around cops. But I think at this point, it's hard to deny that something's going on.
I mean, I would hope that's the case. I would hope, yeah, that I could feel safe because they chose that profession. And
right,
that, you know, like a doctor chooses to save lives. They don't, you wouldn't think that they are going to do malpractice or that they were running scams in their office or that they were doing anything to harm anyone.
Right.
You would hope that because they took, like, I'm a radio person, you know, or I'm a TV host. You would hope that, like, I would deliver the news,
right,
correctly, or that I would study the story enough to give facts.
Right.
Not everybody gives facts when they tell news.
That's true.
Look at Brian Williams. He can't even remember whether he was on a plane or not. But that goes to show you, like, there's human error in everything, and I think that, like, it's unfair of us to just, like, blanketly trust everything. I think maybe we should put other systems into place, but then we're humans creating those systems again. So it's, like,
right,
it's never going to be perfect, and I think when we know that, I don't know, maybe,
yeah,
there will be the solution.
Yeah. But it's, I mean, it's interesting because, I mean, in light of what's been happening, when I first heard the news that a cop killed a person, immediately I thought it's white against black, you know, because that's what's been in the news. And you know what? And sure enough, it happened again. So, you know, we have to ask ourselves and look at ourselves and go, you know, what's going on here? You know, and whose fault is it? I mean, are there more black criminals, there are white ones? I don't think so. You know, they're a smaller part of the population. But, you know, I mean, I don't know if they're more prone to violence or not, or to crime and stuff. But I think cops have been too quick to pull the trigger or kill people. I mean, the guy in New York that they choked to death, you know, who was selling cigarettes on the street.
I mean, the unfortunate thing is that, like, when you think about how many cops there are out there.
Right.
And the ones we're hearing about, they are isolated situations.
Right.
There happen to be several that we're hearing about in a short period of time, so it feels like there's so many.
Right.
But there's also a bazillion other cops that are doing their job every day.
No, absolutely. You know, but often, you know, when someone screws up, you look at their boss, you know, and you have to look at those police departments and ask, you know, are they like a breeding ground for that kind of behavior?
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to look at our culture as a whole.
Yeah.
Also, like, why are we still dealing with things that we dealt with Selma?
Right, exactly.
Like, obviously, this is, if we're removed from it, we think it doesn't exist anymore.
Right, but the world is still, yeah.
There are still states.
Right.
That are pockets of this country that, you know, it's funny because we're dealing with our own internal crisis, and then there are other communities in the world that are fighting us because we're so wrong.
Right.
But we're like, well, we're also not perfect ourselves. We're trying to fix our issues. Why don't you deal with yours? And
yeah,
I don't know.
Well, you know, it would be nice to live in a utopia, but it doesn't seem to happen, man. I don't know.
A simple version of that would be other people minding their own business.
Yeah, exactly. Live and let live, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah. I mean, that's the easiest way for it to happen, but people are so involved in other people's lives.
Yeah.
Well, because it's easier to point out what you're doing versus say, like, here I am doing these things.
Right. Yeah. I know. Finally, they say that a laser procedure can turn brown eyes to blue.
Interesting.
Yeah. Do you have blue eyes? You have blue eyes, right?
I have green eyes.
Green eyes. Okay. Well, it's closer to blue than mine.
Yeah.
But they're saying that just 17% of the world's population has blue eyes. And that's interesting because they're saying, you know, I mean, obviously they're regarded as attractive. Wow, look at their blue eyes. Blonde, blue eyes, whatever. But they're saying they're not really sure why the blue eyes are regarded as attractive.
Well, I think it's probably the unique quality of it because not everyone has it.
Right. Maybe that's what it is. But they also look good. They look like deep, you know, like deep blue and stuff sometimes. And
it's easier to, I think. Okay, so I believe that you can tell a lot about a personality by looking at somebody's eyes. Like, you can tell if somebody's bananas. Their eyes are a little bit like kooky. And like, if you look into a dog's eyes or a baby's eyes, it's very clear what their personality is. So, or like the quality of their personality. So I think with blue eyes, it's easier to look into it because it's a lighter eye.
Right.
And so you almost feel more connected to the person because you can look deeper into their eyes.
Yeah.
So like, I mean, there's an article actually that just came out on Facebook that I posted yesterday that was about like a personality trait based on somebody's eyes. So they say green eyes. I looked at mine because I wanted to know what it says about me. Are more mysterious, are more like adventurous or more loyal or whatever it is. Wow. So, you know, I think they say like brown eyes are smarter or something like that. I don't know. Or are less emotional. Blue eyes are more emotional. You have to read the article. But it's interesting because eyes do say a lot about the person. So I think it's weird if somebody changes their eyes.
Right.
Because that's like the entry to the soul.
Right.
It's one thing if you change your hair color.
That's true. Yeah. Yeah. But they are saying what you just said, that, you know, they stand out in the crowd more. And they're saying also other posit that pupil dilation, a signifier of attraction, is easier to see in lighter eyes. That's very interesting.
It is. Also, lighter eyes are more, it's harder to deal with brightness.
Right.
Like, it hurts me. Like, the sun hurts me, and also darkness hurts me.
Really?
Yeah, so I have a hard time driving at night. Because, like, the bright lights shining into my eyes hurts so much in, like, contrast to the darkness.
Wow.
That, yeah.
That sucks, huh? Because you obviously can't put sunglasses on.
No, my eyes just strain a lot more driving at night. And then also, like, bright sunlight kills me.
Right.
It's, a direct effect to my pupils.
Yeah. See, that does to me, too, as far as bright sunlight and stuff. That's why I always have sunglasses. But when I'm outside, but I don't know if that's from that. I mean, I have brown eyes, but I think sensitivity can come in all colors. You know?
I think so too. I do think that the iris is made up differently because, I mean, obviously the colors are different. Right. So whatever's in your iris, I forget what they're called, but I learned that in science in like eighth grade. But
pigmentation?
No.
Because that's what they're talking about. They're saying that the laser system that they have agitates the pigmentation in the iris.
No, I think that it's like the cones in the eyes.
The cones?
Yeah.
Right.
So whatever those are different for the pigmentation.
Right.
And so they're affected differently by light.
I see.
So that's why it kills me.
Right. Wow. So... Yeah, so there. So I guess there's blue eyes underneath when you agitate the pigmentation of the eyes.
Interesting. Is that why they say all babies are born with blue eyes and then they change?
That's true, huh?
Yeah.
That kind of looks true. Seems true to me. Maybe that's why. Yeah, maybe it then develops or something. Wow. Yeah, well, they're saying it's a safe treatment, but... I don't think I would do that just to have blue eyes.
I wonder what the shade of blue is, too.
Yeah.
Because it can't be a true blue eye. It's probably like a variation.
Well, maybe it's the same blue. Maybe it's just that with the brown eyes, it's covered with something.
Maybe. I'm going to have to see this article.
I know. But I don't want to mess with my eyes at all. You know, I'm still considering LASIK, but... it still kind of scares me.
Yeah. I mean, so. I definitely want to do LASIK. I'm even afraid to do Latisse to make my eyelashes longer because they say that changes the color of your iris as well.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
The eyes are the one thing I'm like afraid to mess with.
Yeah, I know.
Everything else, I don't really care.
I know. Because the eye is hard to understand also. Like, what is it made of? You know, it's like, oh, you know. But, yeah, I mean, one time I just fainted when they put... like anesthetic in my eye, you know, like drops.
Yeah.
And I passed out. I don't know why.
Yikes.
But yeah, because I don't like messing with my eyes. But then I started wearing contacts, and I could touch the eye and stuff, so made it a lot more easier to deal with.
Yeah.
Anyway, folks, this is it for today. Today's Thursday, right?
Yeah.
So we have one more day this week. And that's it. Thanks to Nir Zamir for calling in. Thanks, Jen.
Thank you.
And thanks, everybody. And we'll see you tomorrow.
You're listening to Sam in the Morning with Jen, right here on LA Talk Radio.